While everyone's shuffling in, I think I will call the third case. The third case on our calendar this morning is Sunshine Child Care Center et al. Versus Ramsey County et al. Case number A23-1595. Am I correct that there's a division of oral argument? Is it 14 and 1? Is that the division? Okay. So, counsel for appellant, you'll have 15 minutes. Counsel for respondent, you'll divide your time as you said in our notice, and then counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. If all of the counsel for the audio record before beginning your argument could identify yourselves and your client, we would very much appreciate it. You can adjust the podium, and please feel free to take the moment to get the podium to where it's comfortable for you. You can begin when you're ready.
May it please the court. My name is James Smith, and I am honored to represent the appellants in this case, Sunshine Child Care Center, LLC, City Child Care Center, LLC, and Angels Fun Area, LLC. Their principals have joined us in the courtroom today, and it is a big day for them. Thank you for your attention to this matter. The appellants are all Minnesota small businesses, proudly owned by Somali Americans who each operated daycares that served Minnesota Somali families eligible to receive Minnesota Child Care Assistance, commonly referred to as CCAP. Now, 18 months ago, nearly to the day, respondents publicly accused the appellants of intentional criminal wrongdoing. They revoked their CCAP authorization, and they refused payment that would otherwise be due to them in excess of $250,000. No action or proceeding since, criminal, civil, or administrative, has been brought by respondents or any other law enforcement authority. Now, this case is about whether respondents' actions towards the appellants violated Minnesota law and appellants' due process rights. Specifically, this case presents the question, does Minnesota law authorize respondents to accuse appellants of intentional wrongdoing and then deny them their authorization and payment until the applicable 6-year statute of limitation runs? Now, the district court granted in this case respondents' motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim, finding that respondents did not violate the applicable statutes, namely Minnesota Statute Section 256.046 and 119B.161. Notably, appellants and respondents both agree that the district court's reasoning towards both statutes was wrong. Respondents, however, urge this court to adopt the district court's overall finding on alternative grounds. The standard of review is de novo, and appellants respectfully request that the court reverse the district court's dismissal of their procedural due process claims and their claims for declarative judgment and injunctive relief related to the same. Unless the court would prefer otherwise, I will briefly outline the applicable statutory framework, followed by argument relating to the district court's findings and respondents' arguments related to those two statutes.
So, well, I'd like to begin with your statement that there's been no administrative process. In fact, hasn't there been an administrative review process that your clients have used and they just weren't successful in terms of that administrative process that the agency provides in this context?
So, Your Honor, yes, there has been the process afforded by Minnesota statute that refers to the administrative review. And to our knowledge, that has occurred. Of course, one of the frustrations is that the review of that is solely internal. But According to DHS, that review has occurred, yes.
And so then isn't the real question, the question isn't whether your clients have been given process, the question is whether they've been given adequate process.
Well, I think the question is whether or not they have been given the process due them under Minnesota law via the statutes. So the respondents would argue that they have by citing that administrative review. Our argument is that the appellants are due the due process that is provided under Minnesota statutes, the two statutes that I cited.
If we adopted your interpretation, would we essentially create, because you have to understand the tension here, because the agency can't control what law enforcement are doing. And so does your interpretation ask us to create a moving target for the agency when the agency has no control over what and when law enforcement will do anything? It seems to me that the rule that you're asking us to adopt would in some ways require the agency to predict the future. And I do think that that's part of what the district court was responding to. And so, do you think the statute outlines some really clear guidance for when the agency can step in before law enforcement has made their decision?
So the simple answer to your last question is yes. The statutes have created clear guidance.
Okay.
And those are namely, remember why we're in this position. It's not because of anything the criminal law enforcement or the criminal enforcement agencies did. It's because the respondents chose to make the intentional allegation of wrongdoing and to suspend the payment and revoke.
Did they do that before or after the execution of the search warrant?
They did that after the execution of the search warrant, yes.
Okay.
So, and of course, there's no argument that you're not going to have potential parallel processes here. But given what the statute states with regards to what is required when they choose to make the intentional allegation of wrongdoing and temporarily and withhold payment and authorize, they have control under their standards. So remember, the preponderance of evidence standard has already been met when they decide to make that allegation. There's already been an investigation, and they have already concluded that the same standard that would apply to the administrative disqualification hearing has been met. So what essentially Minnesota Statute 256.046 does is the legislature says if you're going to accuse the appellants of wrongdoing under the preponderance of evidence standard, you must bring forth the administrative disqualification action, which of course applies the same standard that they've determined has already been met.
Right, but then that same statute, 256.046 subdivision 3A, then says, shall pursue an administrative disqualification, but then it says, in lieu of a criminal action when it has not been pursued. So that seems to qualify the requirement to start administrative disqualification action. They're supposed to do it unless there is a criminal action that has not been pursued. And under the facts here, we have at least a criminal investigation that is being undertaken.
And you recall?
Nothing has, we don't have any indication that a criminal action has not been pursued then, right?
Well, we know a criminal action that is not understood as an investigative action has not been pursued because we know that there were no charges brought. Now, whether an investigation...
Is the qualifying there yet?
Yes. And so why is that language there? I mean, that gets to the heart of the matter because it is there and it's important.
But when you say no charges brought, I mean, has there been an announcement of a formal declination of charges by the investigative agency?
No, and that's why I said all we know is that they haven't been brought to date. Now, could they be brought in the future? Yes. And that's part of the flip side. We're talking about the tension on my client's side, and I understand why. But the other flip side, of course, is the tension with allowing the revocation and the payment withdrawal to simply extend for the entire 6 years with zero action brought. So that's the other kind of flip side that we're forced with dealing. So it's a tension between those two, granted, but right. towards
is,
your...
Is there... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to... I was talking about the importance of that language, because it does mean for something. But rather than stating that somehow there's a limitation on DHS from making the administrative disqualification until the charge occurs, or in having to wait until that comes, which, by the way, the respondents are not arguing for, because it's important to understand that as pled in the action, the respondents have brought administrative disqualification actions against providers who were not charged at the time they brought it. So you're not going to hear them arguing that the district court's limitation that it was found is correct. What they're going to argue is that criminal action includes investigatory actions, which is just a backdoor way of saying that we have to wait until the statute of limitation runs.
Those cases you're referring to, were the individuals later charged at the time that the administrative disqualification proceeding began, when they had not yet been charged?
They haven't been charged to date.
No, I'm not talking about your clients, but I'm talking about in the other situations you're referring
That's
to.
That's what I'm referring to.
But are we still within the statute of limitations? Or was there a formal declination of charging announced? Did the investigative agency send a letter saying we are not going to be filing charges? Because that's the distinction, right? I mean, in lieu of a criminal action when it has not been pursued, the agency is ordered to pursue the administrative disqualification once it knows for sure that the criminal action is not going to proceed. So it would be helpful to know if these cases you're referring to had that nuance to it.
Well, the reason I brought up, and no, I mean, the statute of limitation, to my understanding, has not run. The reason it was brought up is just to point out that DHS does take the action and doesn't just sit back and wait. So that's the district court's holding, is that actually DHS is prevented under that language from initiating the disqualification action until either the statute of limitation runs or there's been a formal declination of charges, which... I mean, in the real world, that formal declination of charges doesn't necessarily happen on a regular basis. So we're really talking about the running of the statute of limitations, which, of course, means that it could be up to 6 years before they're able to start an administrative disqualification action, which has to then provide jurisdiction and due process with something that happened 6 years earlier, which presents different issues. But
Counsel, aren't there some... couldn't one read the statute as by indicating the agency should wait until the criminal side of this has been decided one way or the other? Isn't that in some ways protective of your clients? If you go to an administrative disqualification hearing at this stage, isn't it possible that your clients are put in a position that they are assisting law enforcement in bringing charges against them? Isn't that one possible outcome if we read the statute this way? And in fact, by the agency waiting, they are protecting your clients from having to disclose information that could subject them to criminal liability?
Well, Your Honor, I can only speak for my clients. And
well, I guess, so let's take it out of, like, your clients in particular, but, like, in general, couldn't one read the statute as the reason is because they don't want to put child care providers in the position that they are potentially subjecting themselves to criminal liability? And that's why the agency should wait.
I think it's an unreasonable interpretation to say the legislature created a mandate of DHS to bring...
Well, I don't necessarily agree that it's a mandate. I think that by putting in lieu of criminal charges, they are indicating that perhaps it's appropriate for the agency to wait so that the criminal part of the investigation has been decided such that it protects the rights of the people being investigated to not... have to, in an administrative hearing, say or do things that could subject them to criminal prosecution.
Well, there's going to be, pleading the fifth issues with that. However, I think the accused will have the choice as to, you know, what to do in that situation. Because remember, the administrative disqualification action doesn't automatically result in a hearing. If they don't appeal it, it just automatically occurs. So the actual accused, the party accused of wrongdoing will be able to decide what's in its own best interest. But And I see my time's running.
Can I just follow up with one question before you leave the topic? Because the way I understand your argument now is that the agency has the discretion to go to administrative disqualification before criminal the statute is run, before criminal action has definitively not been pursued. But I don't see you pointing to any statutory right. And I think that was a district court's point, is that the statutory language does not require the agency to go to the administrative disqualification until criminal action has not been pursued. That's when it shall do that. And so without that, as a matter of law, how does your claim survive?
Well, the interpretation that we're that's being argued for is that there is a mandate. It does say shall. And the carve-out for the in lieu of criminal action is there because via the statute, and I have it cited here somewhere, but it's in the brief, when a criminal action is brought, the same results as the administrative disqualification action brings will necessarily be brought as well. So it's a duplicative action. It's saying there's no need for a disqualification action if a criminal action has been brought. But at the time you accuse a party of intentional wrongdoing, if there is no criminal action pending, then the legislature says we are requiring that you bring this administrative disqualification action because we want the fraud enforced.
Within what timeline? I mean, the I think that the issue with the argument is what the use of the word shall doesn't tell the agency. Are you saying on the day they make the announcement that they have to bring that they have to start the hearing process on the day that they make that announcement? What is it in the statute that says the time that they've waited thus far violates the statute, as opposed to we're still within the window that the agency can do the shall that appears in the statute?
I see I'm out of time, but may I answer your question? Thank you. The answer is that at the time that they bring the allegation, what the administrative disqualification procedurally then requires is a 15-day notice by which it's going to be brought, and it provides the appellants with the means to appeal. During that time, they can bring...
So you're saying that they have 15 days after the announcement?
They have 15 days after the announcement. That's when the hearing would start. But if they're making the decision to accuse the party of the intentional wrongdoing, then yes, the statute does require that they shall bring the administrative disqualification when that fact pattern has occurred, except in lieu of a criminal action that exists, which is just saying that if there's a criminal action that exists at the time, then there's no need to bring the disqualification action because the criminal action will bring forth the same result. It doesn't foreclose the bringing of the disqualification after the criminal proceeding, because again, there are different standards. So there's a preponderance standard with the administrative disqualification, and of course the criminal standard has the heightened planning. I see I'm out of time, so unless there's any other questions.
I see no other questions. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the county, I believe.
I was going to go first if you want to hear from the county first.
Oh, no. That is just fine. I wasn't sure who was going first.
That's fine. I don't think we were clear, which is our mistake. Good morning, Your Honors. Emily Anderson, Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of Jody Harpstead and the Commissioner of Human Services, and may it please the court. The three daycare centers at issue here today are subject to criminal fraud investigations into their participation in the CCAP program. Because of those investigations, the criminal search warrants approved by a Hennepin County judge and the evidence uncovered by that investigation and search warrant, DHS determined that there existed, first, credible allegations of fraud against these daycare centers, and two, that it was more likely than not that these centers overbilled the CCAP program. So, to stop any potential fraud that was going on, DHS temporarily stopped further CCAP payments.
So this isn't a revocation?
There is a temporary revocation also.
So it's called a temporary, procedurally, can you just lay out for me, like, what procedurally has the agency done in terms of the licensing and the...
So there is no formal licensing action at this point against them. I did check just before. I believe that the centers voluntarily closed their licenses, and there may be one or two of them that are reopening. There are no actions against the licenses. Right now, it is just the authorization to bill the CCAP program, which means these daycare centers could theoretically, notwithstanding the state of their licenses, which I'm not sure about, but again, we're not anything that DHS did to the licenses, could still provide daycare. They just cannot bill the specific government entitlement program while the criminal fraud investigation is
And that's
ongoing.
Called a revocation, or what are the procedural...
Sure, there is a temporary payment stop, which means that all payments that were ready to go out the door are currently on hold. Those are not forfeited at this point. They are kind of, think about it as like kept in an escrow pile. And those are only permanently forfeited if there is a formal disqualification after a criminal or administrative disqualification proceeding. There is also, the revocation piece is a temporary stop from them providing ongoing billing to the CCAP program. So it says, you know, the funds that were on the way out the door, those are held, and then we're not going to let you bill in the interim while this fraud investigation wraps up or goes on.
So there's no way for them to recover the...
At this point, they cannot access the funds for which they have billed. Again, they're kind of in
But if they're continuing to provide services, if they're continuing to provide services that would comply with the program, they are not allowed to bill for those, so they would never be able to recover those funds, or there was not a disqualification, they would be able to in the future bill for those and be able to recover that money.
So the way CCAP works is that the funds are attached to the family, not the provider. So the families are still eligible for CCAP. They can take those dollars elsewhere. The provider, but you can only use CCAP funds at approved providers. And right now, so those families can take their CCAP dollars to other approved CCAP programs. They cannot take them to these programs right now. Again, private pay clients, free to get daycare from these services. It's just these government entitlement benefits that...
So this does really prevent them from providing services to many of the children that they were for this interim period between when this investigation started and whenever proceedings actually do happen.
I agree with the point. I would make the nuance that they are prevented from billing for the program. So they can still provide services to those children. The families can't use their government entitlement CCAP funds.
Is it disputed that most of the children that were receiving their services did get their... Is that disputed?
I don't think we dispute that, but I kind of want to bring this back to the procedural due process claim, which is the claim that we're here on, and the unilateral expectation or structuring your business around a government entitlement program like this has been held pretty much universally by courts to not give rise to a constitutionally protected property interest. There is strong financial incentive in a lot of cases to participate in government entitlement programs. It is not a protected property interest to continue to structure your business that way. That's cited in the Shire case and various cases that Shire relies on.
Which is non-precedential, though.
It is non-precedential, Your Honor, but it is persuasive in that it's the same basic situation. It is the same claim. It's the same temporary payment stop situation, and it deals with a similar government entitlement program. There, Medicaid, here, CCAP. And Shire stands with the great weight of other precedential or other persuasive authority. Federal courts that have analyzed Medicare providers and Medicaid providers in these circumstances have held almost universally the same way, that there is no protected property interest in continuing to receive and provide government benefit services when you are credibly accused of fraud. And that's what we have here. We have a probable cause search warrant signed saying that there is fraud here. We have a DHS investigation into those same things finding that.
You certainly do have to understand the tension, though, with saying simply because this process started with a search warrant, if law enforcement sits on this for 6 years, that is going to essentially destroy their businesses. And DHS is saying, well, we can just sit on the sidelines and wait wait for the 6 years to run. And you have to understand that there is some tension there in terms of you are talking about people's businesses and their livelihoods.
There may be tension, but that doesn't mean that there's a constitutionally protected property interest. And
but is there, but under the statute or under the agency's just basic rules, are there timelines when you are supposed to bring these kinds of actions? Because certainly there are a lot of statutes where the agencies take, are charged with taking certain administrative actions, and there aren't specific timelines on when they are supposed to do them. But one could force an agency to do it because the time is just getting too long, right? We have writs of prohibition and things like that where we can compel agencies to be doing things like that. And why, under our statutory regime, shouldn't the agency be taking an action?
So I'd give two answers there. The first is just that the statutes don't set a timeline. They say in lieu of a criminal action when it has not been pursued. We're bound here by the complaints and appellant's allegations, which are that there were criminal investigations, criminal processes, and those materials subject to the search warrant haven't been returned. That is an ongoing criminal proceeding. And as you discussed with my friend on the other side earlier, that there is a protective nature to that. At an administrative disqualification hearing, you go under oath. And so there is a protective quality to that. I would also say that, like, DHS isn't powerless to do nothing in this light. Like, the temporary payment stop has to end if DHS finds insufficient evidence to continue it. That's part of the administrative review process. Here, the appellants have all taken advantage of the administrative review process, and for the record, that's not a one and done. They can continue to ask for administrative reviews today, tomorrow.
Do you agree that the DHS could start the disqualification proceeding before the conclusion, and that the statute doesn't prevent it from doing so?
I don't think the statute necessarily prevents it. I think it's a matter of discretion. I will say in other contexts, in other government benefit fraud contexts, often when there are statutory deadlines, because there are government programs where, you know, you have to bring it within 180 days, those often end up getting stayed pending the criminal investigation because there are Fifth Amendment issues, because there are issues where we don't want to push people.
Which also would result in the agency getting a less robust record. I mean, there's also it seems to me like part of this is if the criminal charges in this case end with, we are not going to bring charges here, then there isn't a Fifth Amendment problem. So then the agency can have a more robust hearing because you're not worried about the concern about criminal charges being brought by the testimony that's brought under.
100%, Judge Larson. That's absolutely right.
I assume sometimes that a prosecuting agency might provide information directly to DHS that it's not pursuing charges, and that's why, although there might not be a public announcement, that there's a declination that the agency knows
that they can proceed. The search warrants here, which I understand are not in the record but are publicly available, do indicate that the investigator here is a specific CCAP fraud investigator with the BCA, and yes, like there is an informal relationship there. Where they tend, for example, the reason DHS knew about the search warrant is because BCA sent them the search warrant.
But it's your position that we really don't need to get into any of this if we decide that there's no property protected interest in these payments that are on hold.
Exactly. That is our position, and that's how procedural due process works. All of this statutory stuff is interesting, and I think you're right. There are perhaps, if there was a certain statutory duty that we believe DHS is not complying with, there is perhaps a state law remedy for that. It is not a procedural due process claim, and what we're here for is a procedural due process
claim. Well, the statutes are more than just interesting. I mean, they're applicable here, and they're ones that we need to interpret, and they have real-life implications as well. I will tell you, my concern is we're a year and a half into this. After the investigation started, the search warrants were executed, and, I mean, at what point are the parties going to know whether or not charges are going to be pursued or not? I mean, can it go till 6 years?
I am not an expert in criminal statutes of limitations, so I am not going to put my stake on whether it's the 3 years, the 2 years, or the 6 years. I do believe that certainly after the statute of limitations, whatever the applicable one would be, expires, then there is a responsibility to either lift the payment stop or bring an administrative disqualification. Again,
and under that scenario, would the complaint state a claim in this situation? I mean, let's assume we're past the running of the statute of limitations here, and we're now on appeal. Is the issue still whether or not there's a protected interest for
Absolutely. Procedural due process? The question is still, is there a protected property interest? I'm not, I don't believe that my friends have alleged that there is a protected property interest in having an administrative disqualification hearing. Is there a protected property interest, I think, in the funds is the question. And again, the great weight of authority has said that where there's this kind of complicated statutory regime that says sometimes you get these funds, sometimes the agency gets to stop the funds, a lot of that is discretionary, a lot of it is based on lower standards of proof than a criminal standard of proof, there is no property interest in continuing to receive those government money.
So are you saying that there would be no way for a citizen to, so saying the statute of limitations has run, you're saying that there's no way for a citizen to require the agency to do what the statute says that they shall do, or you're saying
I'm
that the
saying
proper
that
mechanism would not be a procedural due process claim, it would be a declaratory judgment or a writ of prohibition or some other type of claim that would mandate, or a writ of mandamus that would mandate that the agency would take
those
kind
of actions?
Yeah,
I think if the appellants believe that there is a sure statutory duty for DHS to take some action, writs of mandamus are for that. That doesn't turn every statutory the theory that they're putting out is that every violation of state law or every time that a state agency doesn't exactly follow a statute or somebody believes it doesn't follow a statute is a federal constitutional problem. And that just can't be the way that we conduct law, that every statutory violation is automatically a federal constitutional concern.
But we do have injunctive relief and declaratory judgment claims here, even though they're tied to the procedural due process argument. So why wouldn't we need to analyze the statutory issues and resolve these problems regardless of the procedural due process?
I would say analysis? Both declaratory judgments and injunctive actions require a substantive legal claim underlying them. And procedural due process is just not that substantive claim here because there is no protected property interest and because in any case, administrative review would be adequate process.
If the criminal action had not been pursued, they would have some type of cause of action under the statute, though, correct?
I don't think that there's a freestanding cause of action under the statute.
Well, at that point, the department would have to pursue an administrative disqualification then, correct?
Again, if appellants believe that there is a duty in statute that the commissioner is not following, there are writs for that. Those compel state agencies to follow duties that are assigned to them under state law.
Right, but my point is, under 256.046, we had talked about the department shall undertake an administrative disqualification in lieu of or unless there is a criminal action which has not been pursued. But if a criminal action has not been pursued, agency knows definitively not one is not going to be pursued at all. Isn't the agency required then because of the shell language to pursue administrative disqualification action?
If there was no existing criminal proceeding, it was closed, declination of prosecution, or the BCA had just said, I don't know what you're talking about, we're not looking into anything here, then yes, I do think that statute contemplates an administrative disqualification proceeding. Again, that does not make it a procedural due process.
Can I ask a follow-up question? Is there any statutory cause of action for that type of violation under hypothetical?
I don't believe the CCAP statutes have a freestanding cause of action within. Like I said, if there are statutory duties assigned to an agency, there are ways to compel agencies to follow those duties. I see I'm out of time, so unless anyone has any other questions, we would respectfully request that you affirm the district court's dismissal of this action.
Thank you, counsel. And for 1 minute.
1 minute. Okay.
May it please the court, Assistant County Attorney Stephen Gershon, representing respondent Hennepin County. First, Hennepin County echoes the state's arguments regarding the appellant's lack of property interest, regarding the authority to temporarily stop payments, DHS's authority, and the persuasive applicability of Shire. but unique to Hennepin County, and for me, the appellant's businesses are located in Hennepin County, and that's where things end. The underlying complaint doesn't assert any real controversy against Hennepin County. Counties are administrative arms of DHS for purposes of CCAP statutes. And here, everything that was alleged in the complaint occurred between DHS and appellants. The original allegations of wrongdoing, all the correspondence, the temporary payment stoppage orders, the administrative review, the request for additional due process, that's all between DHS and appellants. Nothing's alleged against the county. And so my time's out. If I can make my final point, but you don't need it. All right. The county just completely lacks any authority to give appellants what they are asking for here, and so there's no proper complaint alleged against the county, and we respectfully request that that be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant.
There it is.
I used a lot.
So, Your Honors, with regards to Hennepin County's argument, I'm going to just refer you to the brief, and the allegations clearly, with regards to the statutes, apply to the county. It states the county in the statute, so that's why they're included. And they are the arm that administers the entire program, including the granting authority, making the payments. So I'll leave it to the brief. But I wanted to get to the Shire point, because it appears that the respondents are arguing that somehow Shire is controlling, and the district court said, you know, we agree there's no property interest. But I just want to point out that the district court did not agree with that, but the district court said, quote, because the court has determined that respondents complied with the statutes at issue, and because the statutes at issue permit the suspension of payments, the court is persuaded it should follow the Shire reasoning. So inherent in Shire was the statute that authorized the court to find that the statutes allowed for the indefinite suspension. In this instance, we are talking about the application of two statutes that directly affect the due process rights of the appellants, because under our argument, they were required to have received a hearing. They were required to have been able to view the evidence. They would have the ability to offer a defense. And that, it goes to the heart of providing a meaningful due process experience. And under the appellant's arguments with regards to the two statutes, and we only really talked about one, but there's two statutes at play here. Essentially, the respondent's only argument is that purely investigatory actions constitute, quote, proceedings, and they constitute, quote, criminal action. That finding from an interpretative standpoint is required. And if we hold that an investigation is a proceeding under Minnesota Statute 119.161, and if we hold that an investigatory action is a criminal action under 256.046, then both have no meaning, because there will always be an investigation going on at the time the appellants or anyone is alleged to have committed wrongdoing. In fact, they have already been required to find that a preponderance of the evidence exists. They have already found the standard that exists for purposes of bringing the disqualification action. And that is the legislator's intent. When they make that finding, the legislature is mandating DHS, you must bring an action against the appellants or against the provider because you have made that finding and we want them disqualified. Now, if a criminal action exists, we're not saying you need to do the same thing because that already exists. And that is the interpretation that is being advanced here. And it's the most reasonable interpretation when you look at the different standards that apply to the disqualification and the criminal. And it gives the most leeway to the defendants, I'm sorry, to the respondents to actually enforce the law.
I don't know if I agree with that, because isn't part of the, I mean, what we heard is that part of the reasoning is that while the criminal investigation is going on, there are materials that are being controlled by the law enforcement agency, and not all of those are necessarily going to be available to the DHS to use at the disqualification hearing. And so one of the benefits to the respondents is if they wait until after there's a declination of charges or a charging decision, is that all of the evidence is going to be free to both them and to your clients so that it can be used in a robust hearing. They may not be able to make their case until they get all that evidence from the prosecuting agency. So I don't know. Can you address that? I don't know if I agree with the point you're making.
So I guess the assumption, of course, is that they can't cooperate with the other law enforcement agencies to get the information, which they already did obtain.
I mean, not just that, but that the investigative materials that the law enforcement agencies are using, they're not necessarily going to release to the DHS's lawyers to use to prosecute this disqualification proceeding.
I understand. Perhaps they may, perhaps they not. I grant you that. But what I will say is that, remember, at the time they're making the allegation, they have already determined that they have sufficient evidence to bring the disqualification action. They don't need on any other evidence.
Aren't
they don't need anything
else. Stand in the shoes of the prosecuting agency and say, well, they should go forward now and to make that decision for them?
I would say that we're simply stating that if you're going to choose to publicly accuse the appellants of criminal wrongdoing and your basis is already the standard of evidence that you need for the disqualification action, then bring the disqualification action and allow the appellants due process. And
counsel,
I see I'm out of time.
I have one question, and then I'll see if my colleagues do. But how do you respond to respondents' argument that you have this isn't a procedural due process claim? This really should have been brought as a writ of mandamus requiring the enforcement of the shall language in the statute, as opposed to alleging that the process provided by the agency isn't sufficient to satisfy constitutional muster. How do you respond to that argument?
So that was the point of the initial Shire discussion, pointing out that the district court found that it's because the criminal, the statutes were complied with that we don't need to, that Shire applies. But to your specific point.
But then isn't the cause of action a writ of mandamus mandating that the agency should be complying with this statute? Because you're not arguing that the statute wouldn't have provided adequate due process.
Well, we're arguing that they've been denied due process because they're not applying the statute. So that's how we get to the due process argument. But I will make the point also that this case does make, I mean, there's clear injunctive relief seeking exactly what you're just stating could be brought under a writ of mandamus. But it was brought in this action seeking injunctive relief and ordering them to comply with the law. So that is in there, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel, for your argument. Thanks to all of the counsel for your arguments in this case. This case has been submitted, and we will issue a decision in the time prescribed by statute.